Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is a noted British historian and biographer, Andrew Roberts, who's written extensively on military history, especially that of World War II, biographies on noted English politicians, as well as Napoleon Bonaparte. He's also written extensively about Winston Churchill, and he's probably best known for his A History of the English-Speaking People Since 1900, a sequel to Churchill's four-volume work, and his most recent book, The Storm of War, which examined German military decision-making during World War II, which was a bestseller in the UK. Roberts has also appeared frequently on U.S. television, usually concerning British royal state occasions. He's also written extensively on the royal family. He'll be giving a lecture and book signing on the subject of The Storm of War Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus. His lecture title, Why Hitler Lost. Andrew Roberts joins us today here on Studio Tulsa. Andrew Roberts, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Great honor.
Your lecture will follow on two books that you've written that have analyzed first Allied strategy and the most recent, The Storm of War, Axis strategy in World War II. Of course, the enduring debate was how much of what Germany did in World War II was a part of Hitler's ideas and how much was his generals' ideas. And of course, the generals survived, Hitler didn't, so they told the story. How did you get at that question?
Well, what I tried to do was to go back to the Führer Conference's reports. And ever since January 1942, Hitler had every word that was said at these conferences taken down and transcribed verbatim. And so we do know actually what everybody said at these conferences that took place 1,800 miles behind the front in a forest in eastern Prussia, now in Poland, called the Wolfschanze. And so it is interesting how much that diverges from what the generals, who, as you say, survived Hitler, told Allied debriefers after the war.
Where did you see the big discrepancies?
Well, the generals, by and large, claim that they got everything right and that Hitler got everything wrong. And as you'd expect, you know, especially if you're on trial for your life at Nuremberg, it's pretty easy to blame the one person who isn't there and can't gainsay you. But quite a lot of what we read in the verbatim reports from the Wolfschanze do actually gainsay these generals, because very often they were just as wrong as Hitler.
Really, give us an example of a decision we attribute to Hitler that was actually made by the generals.
Well, they're usually not just made by the generals. They're made by Hitler and the generals. Mm. Where the generals claim to have opposed him, very often that they didn't. And one can understand why in a totalitarian dictatorship, of course, why you don't oppose the Führer. But the classic example is the biggest blunder that he made of all, which was his invasion of Russia, Operation Barbarossa, in June 1941, where the generals after the war tended to claim that they were opposed to the invasion, yet it's virtually impossible to find a single serious, you know, major one who actually stands up before the invasion itself and said, look, this is a bad idea. There were plenty who, quite quickly after the invasion had taken place, started to think it was a bad idea and tell each other it was a bad idea and occasionally tell the Führer that it was a bad idea. But at the time, when their voices really needed to be heard, the German general staff supported the invasion of Russia. They didn't oppose it.
Did they feel like the war in the West was over?
Yes, and they were right, in a sense. None of them had any inkling that in June 1941, that by November 1942, an army of some quarter of a million Americans would be landed in first North Africa and then Italy, and then, of course, finally crossing the Channel in June 1944. That was impossible because Hitler didn't declare war on the United States until the 11th of December 1941. So in a sense, of course, they were right. The war in the West was over. They had knocked the British off the continent. The best that Britain could do was to start a bombing campaign against Germany, and that didn't really come until a little later. So all in all, one can understand their sense, especially as they'd knocked out Yugoslavia and Greece in a matter of some 6 weeks in the spring of 1941, why they were so wildly, hubristically overconfident by June.
Now, you mentioned Yugoslavia and Greece. I've read a lot of military history that suggests that that was a major blunder as well, because they were planning on invading the Soviet Union in May. And, in fact, the way I've always read it is that Hitler, I guess there was some terrorist attack in Yugoslavia, or I guess Yugoslavia resisted a civil takeover by Nazi Germany. And so he sent divisions that were supposed to go to Russia to the Balkans first.
Yes, that's right. It was an uprising in Belgrade supported by the British intelligence force services that persuaded Hitler to attack Yugoslavia. But I think it's a huge exaggeration to think that in any way really affected the outcome of the war in Russia. Firstly, many of those divisions were indeed used against Russia. Secondly, the British were knocked off the continent again in Greece very quickly. I mean, the whole thing was over in a matter of weeks. And also, the time that the mud starts to churn up Russia in October really didn't give Hitler quite enough time to capture Moscow. So all in all, I think that's an exaggeration. But nonetheless, you know, of course he'd have done better if he hadn't invaded those countries. But also he'd have had to have left his right flank weak, which is something no commander likes to do.
Yeah. Now, getting back to that decision to invade Russia, is there any evidence that the German generals had ever stood up to Hitler in the decision-making? I mean, you know, in the early part of the war, they said they opposed a lot of things that Hitler did. He turned out to be right as far as the campaign in the West in 1940, which overran France. And prior to that, even occupying the Rhineland, you know, the later accounts suggest the Germans were really afraid that the Allies would just come in and knock them right back out.
That's right. And in fact, the generals had orders not to oppose the British and French if they did move in March 1936. So it was an amazing act of bluff on Hitler's part. And as you say, a series of things had gone right for Hitler. The generals were very opposed to the halt order outside Dunkirk on the 24th and 25th of May 1940, which held back the German armor outside the town of Dunkirk. Had they gone in there and then, they could probably have scooped up the whole of the British Expeditionary Force and imprisoned some quarter of a million British soldiers. And generals like Kleist and Guderian and Rommel wanted to do that. But even there, you see, Hitler's order to stop was supported by Gerd von Rundstedt, who was senior to any of those other three generals that I mentioned. And so he had support from within the Wehrmacht for even that mistaken decision.
You know, when we look at contemporary military strategy, diplomacy has a role in the military decision-making a lot of times. Do you think this was an instance where diplomacy was thinking into the military decisions?
Do you mean with regard to the idea of making peace with Britain and
of halting at Dunkirk so that you could make peace with the UK
this has for many years been presented as the reason behind the halt order. But I myself, in fact, discovered a piece of evidence that completely undermines that, which I published in my book, which you kindly mentioned, The Storm of War. And that is a letter from Major General Alfred Jodl, the Director of Operations at Führer Headquarters, written on the same day, the 28th of May 1940, that the Allies started pulling back and getting men off the beaches at Dunkirk, i.e. the key day. And on that day, Jodl writes that Hitler was fully expecting to capture every Briton and Frenchman in those armies defending Dunkirk. There was absolutely no question, and Jodl would have known if there had been any sense of trying to hold back in order to make peace. Instead, he says the exact opposite. He says that Hitler was looking forward over the next couple of days to capturing the whole of the enemy army.
So the halt was to let the Luftwaffe bomb them and convince them to surrender?
There are a series of reasons for it. That's one of them. Certainly, Hermann Göring, the head of the Luftwaffe, kept promising the Führer that that he would be able to win the battle just by smashing the armies on the beaches and in the city of Dunkirk to smithereens. And like so many promises that Goering was to make in the course of the Second World War, he failed to live up to that one. But there are lots of other reasons too. The men had been fighting, of course, for 2 weeks up to the 24th of May 1940, and Hitler, who had himself served in the trenches, knew how important rest and recuperation was. They were expecting a counterattack from the French from the south, which never actually got anywhere near transpiring, but nonetheless they were concerned about it. Hitler had also lost some tanks in the Polish campaign in built-up areas, and so he didn't want to commit his armour to the city of Dunkirk, because it's the one place where you can take out tanks more easily, i.e. from above. And also there was just this general sense that the whole thing might be a trap. They couldn't believe that the previous 2 weeks had been so successful and that there wasn't some kind of a counterattack, possibly from the RAF, possibly, as I say, from the south, that meant that they were being lured too far. And so there are reasons, you know. They also feared that the dikes were going to be blown and that many of their tanks would just be washed away. There were lots of reasons why Hitler didn't go into Dunkirk and why Rundstedt, therefore, of course, supported him in that decision. But the one that we can be absolutely certain is not the case is the idea that there was some kind of a peace party in Winston Churchill's government that wanted to come to some terms with the Germans.
My guest today is British historian and biographer Andrew Roberts. He's the author of numerous books. His most recent on World War II have been The Storm of War and Master and Commanders. He'll be speaking Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus on why Hitler lost. Well, we covered Dunkirk. We covered the invasion of the Soviet Union in 1941. The other decision that gets a lot of scrutiny is the opening of the Second Front in Normandy on D-Day in June of 1944, where Hitler either believed the propaganda that was coming out of the Allies or just felt he knew that the invasion was going to happen at the Pas de Calais rather than Normandy, and kept his main force at Calais rather than Normandy, and allowed the Allies to get a beachhead into France. I'm sure you dissected the reasoning behind this. What do the documents tell you?
Well, interestingly enough, actually Hitler was about the only person in the top of the high command who did believe that it was going to be in Normandy. Most of the rest of the German general staff assumes that it was going to be the Pas de Calais, which makes perfect sense, of course, because the Pas de Calais is only 22 miles across from the United Kingdom. And they had fallen for a, as you say, this fantastic deception operation, Operation Fortitude, which was a brilliant move on behalf of the Allies to have a general as important as General Patton across the channel from the Pas de Calais in charge of the 1st U.S. Army Group, which didn't exist. All the tanks were made of balsa wood and plywood, and the aeroplanes on the ground and the rest. It was an absolutely amazing operation. It took some 22 agents to constantly feed the Abwehr, the German intelligence, with false information about this. And yet Hitler wasn't fooled by it. He always thought that it was going to take place in Normandy. They thought that the town of Cherbourg, the port, would be captured, and they fortified it immensely, and it was one of the most brilliant parts of the Allied operation to not get themselves bogged down at Cherbourg. But overall, it was taken for granted by the high command, and Hitler was the only person who saw through it. Fortunately, however, he didn't have the courage of his own convictions. And it's very interesting, actually, for a man who's constantly created by Goebbels and others as the all-powerful willpower figure who's the greatest warlord of all time. In fact, very often he did doubt himself, and this was one of those occasions.
Really? Of course, the popular conception is that it was the German generals wanted these forces to be at Normandy, and it was only the personal intervention of Hitler that kept those forces from going to Normandy.
No. Well, it couldn't be more wrong. First of all, the Fuhrer didn't make any personal interventions because he wasn't woken up. He was on that morning. he was allowed to sleep on, which was in itself pretty disastrous. He had set up a very weird command system where basically Rommel and Rundstedt were at each other's throats. Rommel himself wasn't even present either on the morning of D-Day. He was coming back from his wife's birthday party and his car got shot up, and so he wasn't on ready right at the beginning either. But the movement of panzers depended entirely on the personal say-so of the Führer. You could move other units, which Rundstedt and later Rommel clearly did, but to actually move the two panzer divisions in Normandy required the personal say-so of the Führer.
Yeah, I mean, the way I've always heard it was that he, even after Normandy, the beachhead was established, he refused to move them for some time.
That's right, yes, exactly. You see, this to set up a command structure where generals are almost bound to bicker with one another rather than a direct command structure was a classic part of the Nazi state. And it wasn't just in military terms. It was also seen in their economic systems, in their war production systems. Hitler enjoyed being at the apex of a system whereby competing units would sort of argue against each other. He thought it would lead to creative tension, but all too often it just led to tension.
Was there also a fear of the military from Hitler?
Well, there certainly was, of course, after the 20th of July 1944, the bomb plot. But that's pretty much fair enough. If they tried to blow you up, then I don't think anyone's going to be surprised that Adolf Hitler starts to make himself nerve-wrackingly terrifying. However, the fascinating thing is that earlier than that, he didn't shoot his generals. He basically retired them. In the course of the Second World War, Goethe von Rundstedt, who we mentioned earlier, was appointed, sacked, reappointed, sacked, reappointed, sacked, and then reappointed, which is quite something, four appointments or reappointments. Guderian was sent off to be an inspector general of the artillery. He was brought back. Merdel, at one point, was in charge of Army Group North, Army Group South, and Army Group Centre in the course of 1 year, 1944. He was continually, like I mentioned earlier about him not having an iron will, Hitler was continually moving men around from, generals around from front to front, sacking them, reappointing them. And this was a disaster very often, especially after the 20th of July plot, when he started to appoint people basically on their loyalty to him as fanatical Nazis, as opposed to how good they were as generals.
My guest today is British historian and biographer Andrew Roberts. He's the author of The Storm of War, Masters and Commanders. He'll be speaking Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on the University of Tulsa campus on Why Hitler Lost. Well, I want to talk about the earlier book. You're going to be speaking mostly about Axis decision-making. You've also written a book on Allied decision-making and strategy and the very strong opinions of two commanders, that would be President Roosevelt and General Marshall on the American side, Winston Churchill and General Sir Alan Brooke on the English side. We always thought of them really working very well together, but all four had very, very different strategies for tackling Nazi Germany, didn't they?
They did, yes, and they did work together well, but one mustn't assume that it was just, I don't know, good nature or friendship that led to this. They were tough, hard men, both politicians and generals. They had all believed that they knew the best way to win the Second World War, and they needed to get at least two of the other three people on their side in order to get their strategy adopted. And so it led to some pretty tough inter-fighting, really. Winston Churchill would shout at chiefs of staff meetings and would cry occasionally, and Brooke would sit there breaking pencils in half in front of the Prime Minister's face saying, "No, I disagree with you, Prime Minister." And there were rows between the politicians and the generals, and between the Americans and the British. And yeah, the whole book really is full of this of the way in which these four men interacted. But here was, in stark contrast to what was going on at the Wolfschanze, a genuine creative tension. It was creative because at these 10 great meetings, where all four of these men got together around a table, the strategy was chosen that did eventually win the war in the West.
Well, it, of course, I know there were a great variance in strategy. I know that Churchill always wanted to go through the Balkans. What were some of the other approaches?
Well, the big battle, of course, was on the timing and the actual date of D-Day. When were they going to cross the Channel? The British, by and large, wanted to put the date back. General Marshall, in particular, wanted to bring it forward as early as the fall of 1942. There were major operational problems with that, which, of course, I'm very pleased. You mentioned how I was going to be talking about the Axis strategy. I do hope maybe in the question and answer period of the speech on Monday we could get into that as well, the Allied side, because it's obviously something that fascinates me.
My guest today is British historian and biographer Andrew Roberts, speaking from his home in New York City. You can hear the sirens in the background. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. He'll be speaking Monday night at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center, talking about Why Hitler Lost is the name of the lecture, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, I'd like to talk about some other subjects. I know you've written a lot about the royal family, written biographies, commentators at royal weddings and royal events. You know, not too long ago, when you hear talk about the royal family in the UK, you would hear perhaps some talk about, well, maybe the monarchy should end with Elizabeth, or, you know, it was not very popular for a while. Now it seems as popular as ever in recent history. What do you attribute that change around to?
Well, you're quite right. All the opinion polls are showing that the royal family is much more popular now than it has been really since the tragic death of Diana, Princess of Wales. But I think the two things that can be put down to, maybe three things, is firstly the fact that death is now 15 years behind us, and so the shadow of the princess is not quite so ever-present as it was in the immediate aftermath of her death. Then the popularity of Prince William and Kate Middleton, the Duchess of Cambridge, is a great factor in this, owing to the fact that they do seem to be a very upright, decent, and good-natured couple, hard-working as well. And so that's a positive aspect, I think, in all of this. And thirdly, of course, just the wonderful popularity of Her Majesty the Queen. She this year celebrated 60 years on the throne, making her the second longest-serving monarch in British history, in over 1,000 years of British history. So there is a real affection, indeed love, for somebody who's dedicated their lives to us in that kind of way. And her rigid belief in her duty and the wonderful way that she carries it out, I think, just makes her more popular by the day, really. So it is a positive thing for monarchists, and I think quite a lot of that talk that you mentioned has now pretty much completely disappeared.
Well, you know, and it seems like even Charles and Camilla are more popular. It's certainly
much
more popular.
Yeah. Yes, much more popular. You know, the fact is that they love one another, and that comes through tremendously strongly. And you know, the past is tragic, and nobody denies that, but it is very much the past now. She's also proved a very good stepmother to the boys, and quite a lot of their popularity also stems from the fact that they are hardworking. And yes, with any luck, the monarchy has turned a page, indeed a chapter.
Let me ask you one last question. Of course, the big issue in Europe today is the status of the European Union. Of course, the UK is somewhat on the sidelines on the monetary issue. As the British look over to the continent, do you think there's going to be a move to further, I guess, distance themselves from the European Union?
Well, we've always had a pretty semi-detached attitude towards European integration anyhow, and exemplified by the stance taken by Margaret Thatcher, which is pretty much the stance of about three-quarters or so of the British people, which is, yes, we don't mind being part of the Union itself, but there's no way in the world that we're going to abolish the pound and adopt the euro. We don't want to be part of their monetary union. If they insist on going further and deeper and turning themselves into a super state, a single political entity, then we don't want to be part of that. But whilst it's what it is at the moment, we will take the best of it and not take the worst, which obviously the euro, which many of us argued for years was going to be a disaster. And one only has to look at what's happened in Greece and Italy and Spain and other places which are, because of the euro, tied into a system where they have no power over their exchange rates or interest rates. And so no real power over their own economic future. That is absolutely not something that Britain as a nation state is about to go down that route.
One last question. I know you're very prolific. You're writing all the time. What's your next book? Have you started working on a new book at this point?
Yes, actually, funny enough, I've now been working. I'm writing a biography of Napoleon, a single volume, Cradle to the Grave, Life of Napoleon. I've been working on this, I just worked out, for longer than Napoleon himself spent on both St. Helena and Elba put together.
So you've been enduring your own exile, huh?
Yeah, well, exactly, an internal exile of form. There are 3,500 biographies of Napoleon I've discovered
wow.
in the course of working in the New York Public Library, and more books written about Napoleon than there have been days since his death, can you believe? And so, all in all, or at least, you know, books with him in the title or in some way to do with him. So to impose yet another one on the public seems like an act of appalling hubris, but I'm going to keep it myself. I tell myself that, of course, there must be a reason why there are so many books on Napoleon, because people must still be buying them.
That's right. And you've written on the Battle of Waterloo, and so this makes perfect sense, yes.
I've written on Napoleon and Wellington and various other aspects of that period before, but nothing like a single volume biography. It's quite a task, really, but nonetheless very challenging.
All right. Well, we look forward to that, and we look forward to your appearance here in Tulsa. Andrew Roberts, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. I've never been to Tulsa before, so I'm hugely looking forward to it.
British historian and biographer Andrew Roberts speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be lecturing at the University of Tulsa Monday evening at 7 o'clock at the Lorton Performance Center on Why Hitler Lost, which is the subject of his book, The Storm of War, which he'll be signing afterwards. Information at utulsa.edu. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs, they're available online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.